So here's a list of the moments and the stories that you need to know about today.
He plays such a teddy bear, you know, on camera, but then when the light goes off, he's a grizzly bear and he destroys the people. He was saying Ukraine is not ready for democracy. And this is a quote. Another quote was, dictatorship is an order.
The prices of petrol, diesel, gas and fertilizer have increased. They have even crossed the sky. France, we will have to reduce the use of petrol and diesel.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. That's a blockbuster interview that Tucker Carlson did with the woman who reveals what the leader of Ukraine is really like. She worked for him. It's really an amazing interview, and I talked to Tucker. I'll tell you what he said about it as well. And then Runjit Sharma is going to be joining us here. She just concluded an interview with possibly the most important diplomat in the world, who happens to be the foreign minister of Russia. Mr. Lavrov talks to her, she talks to me. That's all coming up right here on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks so much for being among the millions and millions of people watching us all over the world in five different languages. So I chatted by text, as I mentioned a little while ago, last night with Tucker Carlson, right after his blockbuster interview with the woman who worked for President Zelensky. She was President Zelensky's press secretary. It made me think about something that I probably should share with you, that I've always believed. There was a time in my life when I thought I wanted to be a press secretary because I was a journalist. I actually talked to Jeb Bush at one point about him being president and my doing that. So let me start on this subject with Caroline Levitt, right? Caroline Levitt, there she is, smiling big, right? Because she happens to be President Trump's, quote, press secretary. That's her actual title, press secretary. But she's not a press secretary. Far from it. And let me give you some background why I'm saying this, right? So a press secretary is traditionally a journalist chosen among other journalist peers so they can explain to the other journalist what the president's policies are. They were always chosen as journalists, good ones usually, good journalists, maybe the best. That's why they were usually respected by people and generally trusted by people. But Caroline Levitt, she's part of a string of recent appointments in the United States by presidents of both Democrats and Republicans who abandoned this idea altogether. So what we have today in this job, they're not press secretaries. They're usually what's referred to as a public relations hacks. It's someone who's not even remotely objective. They are partisans. They are corporate mouthpieces. They are there to spew talking points. Unfortunately, that's the way it's been now for about 40 years in the United States. What a shame, right? In fact, I'm going to take you through some of these names of these people who've had these jobs, and you're going to recognize some of them. These are people who were appointed over that time period, and they're press secretaries, just like you could say that I am the guy who's going to score the winning goal this year at the World Cup. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to score the winning goal this year at the World Cup, and I'm not. I don't belong in the World Cup, and they don't belong as press secretaries. Just saying. So how did this all start? Richard Nixon, believe it or not, because he was the first to make a real break from the tradition of casting journalists in this role, and he picked this guy, Ron Ziegler. What's Ron Ziegler when he became the press secretary? What was Ziegler? He was an advertising. This guy was an advertising executive. Then came Bill Clinton, right? He continued the pattern with these two, right? That's George Stephanopoulos and Dee Dee Myers. What are they? They were Democratic Party hacks, political party campaign insiders, not journalists. Not credible. They still aren't. Then came George W. Bush. He doubled down with that Ari Fleischer, the guy there on the left of your screen, who to this day is known for what? For lying and lying over and over and over again to the American people, trying to sell them the Iraq War. And Mr. Bush also gave us that woman there, Dana Perino, political operative. Then came Barack Obama. He's same thing. He gave us Robert Gibbs and Josh Earnest. Who are those two guys? Democratic campaign specialists. Their skill set? Making up stories to make Mr. Obama look good. Again, not credible, not journalists. Things were already sliding into ridiculous when along came Donald Trump, and he brought us these three people. Sean Spicer on the left, Sarah Huckabee Sanders on the in the middle, and that's a woman named Kayleigh McEnany. All three spoofed ad infinitum by comedians in the United States. In other words, this job that used to be so respected, it's become a joke. And it continues with President Joe Biden, who appointed Jen Psaki and some woman named Karine Jean-Pierre, both party hacks. Previously, they were political operatives in the Democratic Party. Absolutely no connection to reporting or news gathering or communications or information. They're hacks. And which gets us to the present. This woman, Caroline Leavitt. There she is. Far removed from anything resembling journalism. She actually spends most of her time during her press briefings just, in fact, not only is she not a journalist, she tends to hate journalists and spends all her time fighting with journalists and insulting journalists and criticizing journalists. So is Caroline Leavitt a press secretary? Yeah, her title says she's a press secretary, but certainly not in any other way. That ship, it sailed. However, there's one thing you can say about Caroline Leavitt. She is 100% dedicated to Mr. Trump. Seems very well connected to both the man and his policies. Can you imagine, by the way, if Caroline Leavitt, knowing everything she knows about Mr. Trump, decided one day she would turn on him? What secrets she could divulge, right? Okay, that's what gets me to this. I raise that because that's exactly what has just happened. Not in the case of Donald Trump, not yet, but to Volodymyr Zelensky.
First of all, he's not a person whom you see on camera. He's a very different person. He changes masks all the time. He is emotionally uncontrollable.
Emotionally uncontrollable.
Yeah, he doesn't control his emotions. He's often hysterical, and he thinks that every person is disposable.
That is Juliana Mendel. She's the press secretary for President Zelensky, starting back in 2019. And she's now coming out and revealing what she recalls, and what she calls the real Zelensky, by the way. She worked for the guy, side by side. She was the person responsible for sharing his stories, his policies, meeting with him on a daily basis, responsible for his image. But she now says that image, it was all a lie.
He doesn't have empathy that he plays. He's absolutely insanely great actor, and that brought us a lot of support in 2022. But his acting doesn't have any substance, and everything that he's saying, it's so detached from the reality.
Yes.
And majority of the things that he's saying, it's either manipulation or it's a fact that is being taken from the context, or it's pure lies. And millions of people still believe that supporting Zelensky means supporting Ukraine. But
yes,
today it's different.
By the way, of course, people are already calling her a Putin apologist and all the other stuff, right? The Russian propaganda. Well, guess what? She's not a fan of Russia. Doesn't like Russia. Very critical of Russia's war with Ukraine. Blames Russia for the attack on Ukraine. But she also blames Zelensky, because she says that he could have avoided the war. In fact, she says he promised to make peace with Russia. And that's the only reason, she says, that most of the people who voted for him in Ukraine voted for him in the first place.
We all united, you know, to support Ukraine, but Zelensky abused this unity. He abused our belief in democracy. And Zelensky is an amazing actor. He's gonna give you what you want.
Exactly.
And that's what's happening. He still plays on camera this great guy. But believe me, behind the camera, he's very different. I was working for 2 years. For 2 years, this guy was repeating two phrases, which are very vocal about him. One of them, he was saying, Ukraine is not ready for democracy. And this is a quote. Another quote was, dictatorship is an order. Zelensky came to the presidency as the president of peace.
Yes.
During his electoral...
We've seen this before.
Oh, yeah. He's the guy who made himself in Russia. The first biggest money he made was in Russia, millions of dollars. He was working for Russian propaganda channels, and he was fine with that. And when the war was happening in Donbass already, he was spending time in Crimea having marijuana with his friends from 95th Quartal and making facilities there and enjoying time. And he didn't care that Russia annexed Crimea. So everything that Zelensky is saying is really very different truth, you know, very different truth.
So he was the peace candidate.
He came promising that he would stand on his knees in front of Putin and beg Putin to stop. That's what he was promising.
He was the peace candidate. But instead, she says he's done everything he possibly can to thwart the peace negotiations. Her words. And she says he did it by manipulating the terms to make every potential settlement impossible. Here, she is talking about this.
I believe there were two moments where he could finish this war, but he chose the war of attrition. I don't know how 25 million of Ukrainians who stay in the country can have war with attrition with Russia that has the population of 140 million people. with Russia, who, by the way, in 4 years, has not even borrowed for this war. And Ukraine has the debt of 100% of GDP. At the Munich conference, Zelensky insisted that ceasefire is the condition for peace, for negotiations, and for elections. He is keeping pushing for ceasefire again, knowing that Russia is against ceasefire. It's like the NATO story, right?
Yes.
You know, the New York Times wrote a story that was scandalous in 2023, and the title was Ukraine Will Need to Choose Between People and Territories.
Yes.
And we are indeed choosing. I think it's obvious for Zelensky too, but he thrives on this war. He thrives on this war. Why would he finish it?
She says that the people of Ukraine, and she's close to them, have made that decision, and they're choosing people, not territory. They want this war to end. So why does Zelensky not want the war to end? According to Mendel, it's all about corruption. She says the corruption in Ukraine is not happening around Zelensky, as he has claimed. She says it's happening because of Zelensky.
Usually people are collecting even money for weapons or for Starlink.
What about all the hundreds of billions from the...
Yeah, you need to track it. You need to track it. But look, there is a scandal right now in Ukraine when the Minister of Energy was fired, and it is now known that he helped money laundering $112 million. There is a big Ukrainian oil and gas company, Naftogaz, in Ukraine, and Zelensky just dismissed the independent board and put his own people there. And... yeah, this is something that hasn't been public, but we were talking to anti-corruption activists, and there was money laundering at some point from Naftogaz. I have a friend who was shortlisted for the position of the Ministry of Social Policies during the large-scale invasion. And he was called, and he said that he was one of five candidates. And he would be interviewed by Zelensky and Mr. Yermak, then chief of staff of President Zelensky. And he was told that during the interview, he would need to come up with the schemes of money laundering. So when we're talking about those poor pensioners, you know, and knowing the fact that Zelensky himself approves the schemes of money laundering, I mean, is he guilty? I want your audience to respond to that, okay?
This is interesting, this thing about the pensioners and how many there are. In fact, under Zelensky, Ukraine as a country has been diminished, and she fears that it may eventually be destroyed if they don't stop the war. Here's what she says. She's saying that in Ukraine, there were 42 million people. That was the population of Ukraine, 42 million before the war started. She says millions and millions of people have left Ukraine, right? Most of them were, and this is important, able-bodied workers. They were taxpayers, right? Younger. Today, she says, there's only about 20, think about that, from 42 to 24 to 25 million people left in Ukraine. And half of those are either kids or children or retired pensioners who depend on the government for income. They're not putting into the government, they're taking, right? Because they're older, like anybody on Social Security in the United States. And they need to be helped. She says Ukrainians in general hate the war, but those who complain about the war, they are often sent to the front lines. In fact, we've gotten a couple of video scenes that we're gonna show you. These are videos, by the way, before you watch them. Look at that guy right there. These are videos from the last couple of days of Ukrainians actually being dragged from the streets, from their homes, from their jobs, and sent to the front lines. You saw that man right there walking down the street when suddenly a government vehicle blocks him and two agents jump out of the car. They're chasing him, and you're about to see that eventually they pull him from the alleyway where he goes running. And then they drag him, and now you're about to see them, watch, right here, watch, boom, as they throw him inside the van, and that's it, that guy's gone. Next thing, he'll be in the front lines and possibly, good God, deceased. It's terrible. And by the way, this is happening without war. Let me show you another one. Here's another video. Look at this next video. Look at this. This is a case of a guy just beaten to submission. The guy beating him, nobody knows who the hell that guy is. He could be an agent. He could be a police officer of some type. There's no due process when this happens. It's lawlessness. It's like some goon just shows up unannounced without a warrant, and he just beats the hell out of people and then drags them kicking and screaming to the front lines. Again, no explanation, no warrant, nothing. Mandel says Zelensky uses these kinds of forced mobilizations as a tool carry out his personal vendettas. She says people who wrong him or speak out against Zelensky, they're the ones often dragged out the streets, beat up, sent to the front lines, like you just saw. So she describes Zelensky as crazed and vindictive. I've never heard that before from somebody, but she says that's what she saw. She says the image that is portrayed of him by Western media is false. She says he does arrest bloggers and influencers as well who criticize him. And as far as allegations of his use of cocaine, she says she hasn't actually seen him do cocaine, but listen to this story.
Zelensky using cocaine?
Again, I have not seen that. So the thing is that all these people are talking about cocaine, yes. The second thing is... every time when we were preparing to the interview, you know, I was reading the notes, explaining who is the journalist, what he needs to say, the messaging, the questions. He does not like reading, to be frank. Usually he's more, you know, like tries to listen to you. And then he takes his like 15 minutes in the bathroom. And I'm telling you that I was always surprised that he was going out a different person, like really always a different person.
So you'd be briefing him.
Then he goes to the bathroom, he spends there 15 minutes and he's going out energized, full of, you know, action, ready to say everything.
Sniffing.
What does that sound like? Look. It's highly unusual for somebody with such a personal and professional connection to a country's leader to criticize him so aggressively, right? That's why I found this absolutely fascinating. Mandel is worried about what might happen to her. She suggests that somebody might even try to kill her for what she has said. She says she does this because she loves Ukraine. She wants the war to end. And she also wants Zelensky's European backers to hear this message.
He plays such a teddy bear, you know, on camera. But then when the light goes off, he's a grizzly bear and he destroys the people. It's almost surreal to recollect that almost every Western leader and Western delegations that were coming to Ukraine before the war, they treated Zelensky as a political novice. They saw he was low educated, unqualified and low depth. But then overnight, he just turned into this great face of democracy.
Yes.
But it feels like the West created the myth, fell into it, and, you know, doesn't that the West keeps ignoring the fact that this beneath that Zelensky's rhetoric, heroic rhetoric, he keeps accumulating power. And I'm not afraid to say he keeps hollowing the very same people he claims to save.
So let's get down to this part. Remember, by the way, at the very beginning, I mentioned that there's a difference between a press secretary and a presidential spokesperson. Caroline Leavitt, clearly a spokesperson. No journalism chops whatsoever, right? None. Yulianna Mandel, interestingly enough, she's actually a journalist. And she's written, she's produced for Vice, for the New York Times, for Der Spiegel, among others. As for Tucker's take on her, he told me last night when I asked what kind of vibe that he got from this woman, because I was fascinated watching it. He said he thinks she's totally real. And he said she's courageous. And as for her suggestion that they might try to kill her, as she said, he says, yeah, he believes it. He thinks it's true. All right, so change gears here a little bit, because while these revelations about Yulia Mandel and Zelensky, they're brand new, there's one man who's been turning up the heat on Zelensky's regime for a long time and suggesting that these things were actually taking place. Of course, he's a partisan because he's Russian. He happens to be one of the most important Russians. He's Russia's very own foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. He just sat down for an exclusive interview with RT head of the Indian News Bureau, Runjhun Sharma. And she just stepped off the set. So she's coming here now. She'll be sitting right here to talk about what's going on with revelations having to do with her interview with Mr. Lavrov, what's happening with India as it relates to the situation in Iran. There's really a lot to talk about. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Let me tell you something. Some of the best journalism in the world takes place in India, and we happen to have the boss lady, the person who is in charge of RT's India Bureau, Runjhun Sharma. So great to see you.
I'm so happy to be here, Rick. You know, I love your studio. I have been eyeing your studio. It's so nicely done.
You can borrow it anytime you want. Just leave the money right here.
Thank you.
All right, so let's talk about first things first. You literally talk about hot off the press. You just finished an interview with Mr. Lavrov. And I imagine there's a lot to talk about. He's been saying a lot about what's going on, particularly when it comes to the United States and what the United States has been doing in Iran. It's almost impossible not to look at my president right now and not criticize him. But he had some pretty strong words for him, didn't he?
He did. In fact, it's a very timely interview, I would say, Rick, given the fact that the foreign minister is traveling to New Delhi tomorrow for the BRICS foreign ministers meet. And again, the center of this meeting will be Iran, what's happening in Iran and the residue of that war, of that conflict.
Here's what he said. We've got a clip. We're not going to give away everything, but here's a part of what he told you. Let's take a listen to that if we can. Jean?
At the Strait of Hormuz tensions, they are pushing several Asian countries, including Japan, to increase their Russian oil imports. How do you view this shift, Mr. Foreign Minister, especially given the earlier Western pressure on these countries to not buy Russian oil at all?
You know, I would not like to comment this at length. They put pressure on everyone, demanding that they should not purchase Russian oil, and this is unfair play. These are colonial or neo-colonial methods. You can describe it in different ways. But we're talking about these methods to exploit others. You shouldn't purchase cheap Russian oil. You should purchase my expensive oil and buy expensive LNG from the US. We will rule the world by controlling global energy. Not everyone caves in to such pressure. India has repeatedly stated that it will define on its own whom to buy energy from. Well, reportedly, Indians refused to accept one tanker carrying Russian oil. But all in all, India has made its position pretty clear.
We will rule the world, says Mr. Lavrov about the United States. We will rule the world by telling people who they can buy oil from. I mean, he's right. It's a fair criticism. And you could tell he's aggravated about it.
And rightly so, right? I'll give you an example. In India, for example, the biggest democracy in the world, ever since the war in Ukraine started, 2022, India started buying Russian oil. Mm-hmm. Cheap, discounted Russian crude. Why? Because India needs it. And for India, comes first national interest. But oh my God, Rick, the number of times somebody in the US, from, you know, top to the bottom, harrowing India, pressuring India to stop buying Russian oil. Mm-hmm. But India's been very, very clear that India will do what India thinks is best for India. And it's funny because it almost irks the West because they think that, you know, they will say, you know, this is what you have to do and this is how you have to do it. And if India doesn't do it, it's problematic, right? Mm-hmm. It hurts the ego. And it's been going on since. And now, after the war in Iran started, the US themselves, they said, you know what? There's a bit of a waiver and we will allow you to buy Russian oil. But India was like, what? We've been buying Russian oil all along.
But that runs out May 16th, right? I mean, this deal or this extension of secondary sanctions or whatever the hell we want to call them has been extended. You would think, given what's going on and the news out of Iran today is not good, this doesn't look like it's going to be settled anytime soon, according to Mr. Trump's words this morning. You would think that he will extend this thing, right? Do you know?
Even if he does not, what I know for sure is that India will not stop buying Russian crude. That's very, very simple. Look, when Rosneft and Lukoil were sanctioned...
Those are the two big Russian companies.
The two big oil companies based out of Moscow. For a brief period of time, the oil imports, they dropped Russian oil imports to India. But they've been consistent. Today, Russia is the number one oil supplier in the world to India. And Russia was nowhere before 2022.
And Russia seems to have more oil now than just about any country in the world and has the ability to get it to all other countries more than anybody else because of what's going on in the Middle East right now. In fact, we've got Lavrov talking to you, I believe, here about Russia's position on India, where it is and where it's going. Let's take a listen. Here's your conversation with him about Russia.
I cannot rule out that in your relations with your neighbors, there's quite a lot of impact by external factors, and they have an interest in you being busy making strife with each other instead of concentrating on the tasks that we have already spoken about today. By that I mean developing Eurasian intercontinental integration. The West does not want that at all. The West wants to set their own rules in Eurasia. They are creating all kinds of quads and trios and so on. However, when the terrorist attack happened in April 2025, President Putin was one of the first leaders who condemned it in very harsh terms and expressed his sincere condolences to the Indian leader and Indian nation. We have great sympathy for everything happening in India. Unfortunately, quite often natural disasters happen in India, and such terrorist attacks, we feel fully for the Indian nation. We have always tried to help overcome the crisis and are trying to build dialogue. I spoke with Foreign Minister Jaishankar and Minister Dhar as well. We know about the position of our Indian friends, that all of that, just like in your relations with China, primarily it's a matter of bilateral relations. India does not have an interest in some kind of mediation or stewardship, and we have full respect for that position, and we believe that it is very reasonable.
You know, he's right, and let me tell you about my own ignorance as a Westerner. I've always seen India as a country that wants to align itself more with the Western culture, the Western perspective. So I have been taken aback by India's resoluteness on this topic. India is not afraid to tell its Western allies, sponsors, whatever word you want to use, go to hell. No, you know what? We have a relationship with China. We have a relationship with a burgeoning relationship with China. We have a very good relationship with Russia. And we're going to continue those relationships because they're important to our 1.4 billion people. I don't know why. Again, I plead ignorance here. I thought they would do everything possible to not lose or in any way obfuscate or insult is a better word, their Western friends. But they have shown that no. What's important for the economy of our people is more important than anything when it comes to culture or values. Did I get that right?
You did. And I wouldn't call you ignorant completely, because even within India, Rick, it was somewhat seen that India is aligned to the West,
yeah,
while Russia remains a very, very trusted friend. Having said that, in all of these years, in the last decade or so, more, India's also grown as a country. India's also gained confidence. And that's where I would also want to give credit to Jaishankar, India's external affairs minister, because
yeah,
he has really told the West to, you know, go take a walk.
Yeah.
We are not going to listen to you just because you're the West and just
yeah,
because you think you're this great superpower and you dictate to the world what you do. In fact, I remember Jaishankar one time in the U.S., Trump giving this speech, and the entire hall, Rick, stands up, a standing ovation. And there's Jaishankar just sitting like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
Just that. It's a change. And it's a change in India's foreign policy, but also India's become a more confident country now, the fourth largest economy
yeah,
in the world.
Yeah. And growing, by the way.
And growing. Yeah.
All right. So now let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Iran vis-a-vis not just India, but Thailand, Vietnam, countries all over Southeast Asia. And by the way, Western countries as well, because of what's happening in Europe with the oil prices and what was just announced today in the United States of America with the CPI report, which is horrible. I'll share some of those numbers with you in a minute. Here's Mr. Modi talking about what Indians need to do to, buckle up a little bit to be able to get through this crisis. Here it is.
In the last 2 months, there has been such a big war in our neighborhood, due to which we're facing supply chain problems. Because of this war, the prices of petrol, diesel, gas, and fertilizer have increased. They have even crossed the sky. Friends, we will have to reduce the use of petrol and diesel. Wherever there is metro, we will have to use only metro. We will have to use the metro as much as possible. If it is necessary to go by car, then we will try to adopt carpooling and take more people in the car. If we have to send goods, then we will have to send them via railway services, so that due to being an electric railway, petrol and diesel are not needed. Those who have an electric vehicle should also try to use it as much as possible.
God, this reminds me of 1978 when President Carter, at the time, Jimmy Carter, who ended up being a dear friend of mine. I love that man because he's a very good man. But he gave a speech similar to this, actually telling Americans that they needed to use, you know, austerity measures. Yeah, he actually went a little too far and told people to go in the forest, cut down wood if they have to heat their homes, which he got in trouble for. But this kind of stuff is a reflection of what's happening in the country right now. How serious is it? What are the implications? Are they political? How do you see this, Runjun?
Look, firstly, whatever Narendra Modi, the Indian Prime Minister, has said, it's more of a suggestion, an appeal coming from him. It's
yeah,
it's not restrictions that have been imposed on the country.
It's not public policy.
It isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't. And, you know, it's, what, 75th day of the Iran war?
Mm.
This mindless, endless war? There's so much uncertainty. That's a mild word for what's happening in the world right now. So, Narendra Modi, he came up with these 7 odd points, and he said, okay, you know, try and work from home as much, you know, use public transport. Don't buy gold. Don't go to foreign vacations.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at it emotionally, it does sound like, oh, my God, like, what is the country going through? But if you look at it from the lens of an economist, what
mm-hmm,
are they doing? It's a forex crisis management of sorts. Because India, it wants to protect its forex reserves. And why not? I mean, look at so much uncertainty in the world. Let me also point out, when he says that India should not Indians should not buy gold. Mm-hmm. You know, we're obsessed with gold. Indians like buying gold.
I didn't know that.
it's a fact. So during weddings and, you know, just if you have like a little bit extra money, what do you do? Buy gold.
Buy gold?
Yeah, that's what we do. So some 25,000 tons of private gold in Indian households. And what it does, it inflates the import bill.
Ah.
So what Modi is saying is just easy for a little bit.
Interesting.
You know?
But by the way, India does have a problem with two things, it seems to me, from my read, by the way. And you correct me if I'm wrong. It probably should increase its refining capacity, and it probably should increase its warehousing capacity. In other words, when you drive around in the West, the United States, all over the place, and in other parts of the world, you see these basically tank farms,
yeah,
where you see all the oil is kept. India doesn't seem to have enough of those, both for jet fuel, for diesel, and for regular gas. Is that right?
I do agree with you, but I also disagree. I'll tell you why. So in the last few months, India has increased its domestic gas production, for example. Mm-hmm. So when the crisis hit, India's, of course, trying. It cannot happen overnight. But also we need to understand that India is a country that depends about 90% on imports when it comes to crude.
Right.
So yes, there has to
be.
Is
there a place it can? I guess what I've heard some people in the energy experts say is India and some other countries need to find a way to not only import it, but then when it gets there, find a way to keep it handy so it can't get into this kind of crunch that it's in right now.
Well, India has about 60-odd days of reserves at the moment.
Mm.
Is that enough? Maybe not.
For 1.4 billion?
Exactly, 1.4 billion people. More, we were just chatting earlier. The census is on now, so I'm pretty sure that number is going to be inflated. But, you know, this is a crisis which is inflicted on countries like India, on developing countries. And I always say that, Rick, these mindless wars are started by the West, and it is the global South that pays the price.
Well, wait. No. I just got a report. This is interesting you said that. About 2 hours ago, I checked the wires, as people like you and I constantly do, and I saw the United States just released its CPI numbers, right? And the CPI numbers adjusted annually are 3.8%. As most of you know, the rate of inflation needs to be kept by most economists somewhere around 2%. The United States is almost at 4% right now. That means it's doubling its inflation rate. The report on shelter, up. Food, up. Clothing, up. Homes, up. Gas, real estate, up. Everything across the board in the United States is more expensive right now. And we're seeing the same pattern in places like in Europe, for example. So, yeah, places in Asia, for example, are going to get hit hard. But we're seeing it all over the world right now.
And in the Western commentary, when you see the Western headlines, they would never talk about the U.S. or Europe like, oh, poor U.S. and poor Europe. But when it comes to the Global South, when it comes to India, when it comes to South Asia, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, it's always like, oh, poor countries, look at them, you know, grappling with energy crisis. So that makes the narrative a bit different.
Explain to me what India's position is on all this. And I think it gets a little complicated for India because India has always been so good, and I think Mr. Modi reflects this, at playing the field. India doesn't give itself to anyone. You have to earn them, right? You have to earn their Mr. Modi or India's respect. This situation with Iran is quite interesting because India will get petrol or gasoline or commodities of any kind from whoever gives them the best price. We've seen that in the case with Russia. But India has kind of created a little bit of a complex situation with Iran insofar as its association with Israel. Where is India's position right now vis-a-vis the Middle East with both Iran and the Gulf states, et cetera? Is it just playing the field? Because it's not turning against Israel like other countries are. It's having a respectful relationship, it seems to me, with even the Netanyahu government, while also not walking away from the Middle Eastern government.
Well, India keeps the position of neutrality, if I can put it like that. Of course, just before the war, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi was in Israel. And
he got heat for that.
He did. Yeah. Because it was clearly an incoming war. But somewhere in...
And there's Gaza and there's everything else that's happened. And, you know, people are saying you shouldn't go there. But you know what? He's the boss.
He is the boss, and also Israel has been a friend to India. It's a fact.
Yeah.
And it's also a fact that India doesn't take sides, you know. That's the thing about India. It's non-aligned, you know, non-alignment movement. It started during India's independence, and India still does that. So India is not out there to, like, criticize a country and pick sides and say, you know, this guy is evil and this guy is...
Yeah.
You know, no.
Like my country does.
Yes. And they want India to do that. And each time, like during the Russia-Ukraine conflict, when India was not picking a side, the West was going crazy. Like, you know, pick a side, Modi. And he was like, no, I don't need to.
Yeah, it's complicated. So, in the case of Iran, I would imagine by now it would be hard for them not to look at this and fault both the United States and Israel. They did start this war.
Yeah.
It was not Iran.
Yeah.
What's the commentary in India about this war?
Look, at the moment, what India is looking at is the Strait of Hormuz, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz.
Business.
And, you know, that's impacting India. Now, if you go out today and buy a cup of tea, it costs more, you know. It used to cost 10 rupees earlier, and now it costs, like, 15 rupees. It's not too much of a difference when you and I are sitting here in the studio and talking, Rick.
Yeah.
But you know, when a rickshawala has to go and shell out money, it pains. It aches. But when it comes to diplomacy, India's talking to both sides. India's hosting the BRICS summit this year.
Yeah.
And there will be all sides, right? There will be Iran, there will be Saudi Arabia, there will be UAE. And while the Western commentators are criticizing BRICS, they're calling it fragmented and fractured, but the point remains that they will still sit together on a table. And the idea of BRICS, the idea of finding alternates to Western, forums and Western institutions, that remains.
Yeah, and that's India's gift to the world in many ways. It's in that perch. It's in that perfect place, right in between the West, Russia, China, the Middle East, and all the other things that are going on. And I think it plays that card very well. Wow, you are such a superstar. You're doing such a great job. And ever since you started the bureau in Delhi, it seems like there's been an information flow, more of a connection between this entity and the people and the consumers in India. How's it going in general?
Very good. In fact, what we're trying to do, Rick, is not stay limited just to New Delhi, to India, but we're doing stories from Bangladesh, from Nepal, from Sri Lanka. And it's been going pretty great, you know, ever since Vladimir Putin, Russian president, formally launched us in December last year. We've been on quite a roller coaster ride, I would say, Rick, and I'm glad you're watching, and all the compliments coming from you, they mean a lot.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, because I watch a lot of Indian news, and I find it absolutely fascinating. They have more energy than me. In the way that they do. When you watch an Indian telecast, there is a passion about it, which is attractive. I think is how have you been able to mix your style, our style, the RT style, into that to either make it different or the same? How have you thought through that?
It's a very interesting question you ask, because you're right. You cannot match up with the energy of Indian presenters and just how they, you know, the look and feel of it. There's fire coming out of screens.
It's like a movie.
Yeah, it is a movie. And, you know, it's not a newsroom, it's a war room in Indian channels. But what we're trying to do is we are trying to bring the India story from a very global lens. So doing local stories from a global approach and global stories from a local approach.
Yeah,
something
yeah.
like that. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of like what we do here on the Sanchez Effect, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not here to cover the Duma. I'm not here to cover Russian politics. I'm here to tell you from this perspective what's going on in the world, right? It's a global perspective. And you know why it's so important for you to do that? I think it's so important for you to do that because the alternative is to get news from London or to get news from Paris, which, pardon me for saying this, but is generally bullcrap.
It is.
Because it's the same thing they've been doing for 100 years. And generally speaking, I think those folks are always going to look down on Indians because they used to own you. and they want to still own you.
It is a fact, Rick. I mean, it's incredible the kind of stories that come out of, I don't want to name names, but Letney, you know, like BBC and CNN.
Yeah, yeah.
Each time there is a crisis, they would paint India. You know, actually, what? Let me give you another example.
Okay.
So say, for example, you are doing a story, a Western publication is doing a story on a farmer protest. Uh-huh. You know how they would write their script? How they would start their script? India, where 70% of the population lives in slums.
Yes.
So they
yes.
love to paint that picture of India and show India its place, what they have in their head. Mm. And that's why each time there is an achievement, say, you know, India reached the moon, but they would like to throw India back. Mm. I was talking to you earlier about, you know, this white
it's man. It's so true. It's
burden.
So true, the way they use words. And they fit them in there, kind of like they modify their language with insults. And they do it in such a way so that you barely notice it. But folks like you and I do. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Keep going with that.
No, I mean, and that's what I was saying. So when you do this, when you build the narrative this way, when you're painting a picture of India by using words like slums and poverty and garbage, what are you trying to do?
Yeah.
You know, and it's very different, the kind of journalism they do in India and they do elsewhere. If the Indian government or if Mr. Modi, for example, says something to a Muslim, he's Islamophobic. But
yes.
if the leader in France, he bans burqas, that's nothing. That's not making global
exactly.
headlines. And let me tell you, Rick, that the Western media does not hate just Narendra Modi. You know, they've hated Indira Gandhi and then Manmohan Singh, their diplomats in the UN. They used to call them snakes and whatnot. But with RT India now, and a lot of our audience says they're watching us, and they see the difference, and they see the BS that some of these Western publications have been in the name of journalism doing in India.
It's funny because I even to this day, almost every single day, I read a commentary where someone says, I can't believe I have to watch you on Russian television to know the truth about my country.
Wow. That says something,
that
right?
That is something, right? That is something. Well, speaking of commentary, stick around. I got a couple of commentaries here. At the end of the show, I always like to see what people are saying about me, good and bad. These are the comments, and we begin with reaction to the story about CNN. When I worked there, they never let me cover CIA coups in Latin America. So Senior Winky defends CNN and says, I am a clown. He says, remember, you're an anchorman, a presenter, a reader. Don't confuse representing with reporting. CNN knew to keep the serious journalism with the adults and not the clowns. Actually, Mr. Winky, I was a crime beat reporter, a city hall reporter, and I produced 4 winning documentaries. If that isn't reporting, please let me know what else I can do then to satisfy you. Let me know. Lucas W. says, what was the reasons they gave you for shutting it down? That's a good question, actually. You know what they said? They said, we don't want to cover stories that make us look like we're socialists. So they stopped me from doing those stories. And they said that if I did those stories, then Fox News, the conservative network, would have a field day with CNN. And they'd say that we're anti-America at CNN. Regarding the lessons I learned from my father, who had only a 4th grade education, Dalia Canora says, thanks for sharing your personal story. It's criminal what we've done to the world and its beautiful people. And then Tara 2022 says, Do you ever consider what you got told by your father was actually propaganda? No, Tara. It's all documented. Look it up. Look up Allende in Chile. Look up Arbenz in Guatemala. Look up President Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. And while you're at it, look up Batista in Cuba. And that's where you could just get started, by the way. There's a lot more. Rio Flash River says, yes, of course, the communist Marxist ideology and the Islamic ideology to take over America is not true. Right, Rick? All that is an op, right? It's not really happening before our eyes. You're a joke, dude, he says to me. Oh, my God. Mr. Flash, I'm just wondering, are you writing this from the 1950s? Because while you're there, say hello to Joe Biden for me. And while you're at it, say hello to Joe McCarthy as well. And then finally, Muji Willie says, I stopped watching American movies a long time ago after I realized that they're very strong propaganda tools. There's always an agenda. The films always depict specific people as terrorists, thugs, spies, and prisoners. Yep, that's what we were just talking about. And Russians are big brawling bullies, and Asians are sneaky, and Arabs are terrorists, and Hispanics, well, we're all maids. Or we, you know, cut the lawn. We're all subservient. I could go on, but I won't. Finally, Ludwig Filippopoulos says, Clayton Morris and Natalie Morris do an excellent job every day on redacted news. Everyone should be watching them by now. I agree. That's why we had them on. So there you go. Nice comments, huh? A mix. It's a little good and a little bad, right? As usual, all the feedback is appreciated. You can check out my social media. We're on X, we're on Spotify, we're on BitChute. Thanks so much for being with us. And as I always like to say at the end of this newscast, most importantly, thanks so much for letting us into your homes. See you next time.